Well, it's a great pleasure for me to introduce Professor Krista Kalman this morning. She's a graduate of Keele University, and she taught for a while in schools before coming to the University of York, where she worked for her PhD in the Centre for Women's Studies. Her research was on women and politics in the late 19th and early 20th century, with special reference to Liverpool. Then, having taken her PhD in 1994, she did some teaching in the York History Department before being appointed to a lectureship in the School of Cultural Studies at Leeds Metropolitan, now Leeds Beckett University. Then in 2006, she became Professor of History at the New University of Lincoln, where she has been responsible for building up the History Department. She's published numerous books and articles on suffrage campaigns, and more recently also has been researching women's lives and in other contexts, as, which seems fascinating to me, as war brides in France during the First World War, as campaigners for post-war reconstruction, and as activists in a number of other campaigns in the interwar and post-war years. So she's ideally qualified to talk to us this morning on local histories and the suffrage centenary. Krista.
Thanks, Claire. I didn't do a sound check, but I'm guessing that if you can't hear me, you're going to let me know. So I shall keep looking up. It's less of a formal, heavy academic paper this morning and much more of a run-through of how the suffrage centenary impacted on local history and how local histories informed the way that we thought about the centenary. So I think you would have had to have been completely divorced from all forms of media, print media, social media, television, anti-social media, whatever, to have missed the fact that last year was the centenary of some, not all, some British women getting the vote. And of course, this was the first thing that those of us that were repeatedly wheeled out to comment on this in various different public forums were trying to find a shorthand to get across. There really isn't a shorthand for women got the vote if they were over the age of 30, qualified for or married to somebody who qualified for the local government franchise, or if they were a graduate of a university when they could vote for the university seats. So I think we all settle for partial suffrage or some women's suffrage. Building up, though, from actually round and about 2004, when there were quite a number of events in radio and print media to commemorate the founding of the Women's Social and Political Union, sorry, in 2003, and then a series of other anniversaries that came on the back of that, a lot of excitement in 2013, commemorating the anniversary of Emily Wilding Davison's death at the Derby, and then of course the First World War commemorations that started in 2014 and went on obviously literally as long as the war itself, so kind of ended around in about 2018, and the suffrage commemorations getting caught up in those. But I think that many of us were astonished by the level of excitement that centenary provoked and the amounts of interest. And if I can just give you an example of this, that there were ever so many people desperately trying to pitch to broadcasters, can we do something on suffrage? Can we do something on suffrage? And nobody was interested. And then suddenly, round in about November, literally, it all really kicked off, and programmers woke up to the fact that there was this thing called the centenary coming. So, for example, some of you may have seen the BBC programme Suffragettes with Lucy Worsley, which I was the consultant on, which won a BAFTA 2 weeks ago. So I think I can genuinely now say I've won a BAFTA, which isn't bad going, although I didn't get to put my frock on for the ceremony, unfortunately. They literally telephoned me about that programme in November when it had just got green-lighted. I still have somewhere on my computer a copy of the first draft of the script with comments and feedback and amendments dated the 25th of December, the 26th of December, because that was how tight the deadline was on that. And we wrapped in February for a broadcast in May. So going from, no, we're not interested in this, we're not going to touch it, to actually we're going to give it a 90-minute top billing BBC documentary in the space of about 3 months. And other events, processions, which I'll talk about a little bit more in a moment, the performance artwork event that took place in all of the UK capitals last June, the exhibitions at Westminster Hall in Parliament, in Portcullis House, the fantastic Centenary Day reception when every single living woman MP was invited, and as many who were capable of coming came back down to Parliament. I think in Theresa May's case, I think the centenary was the only bright light in her whole firmament last year, because she kept on actually replying to invitations. And at first people were saying, oh, she won't come, you know, because she's really busy, she's the Prime Minister. And she kept on turning up at all these things. And as the year went on, we realised that actually it was the only place that people would sort of smile at her and be nice to her. So I think she was kind of desperately saying, when's the next suffrage event, quickly. So it was more or less impossible to miss that these things were going on. And there was, of course, a really big local dimension to this. And one of the things that helped this was recent technological advances, which have made things visible, which were previously not totally invisible, but very, very difficult to find. I'll talk through the example in a moment. I think the best thing about the suffrage centenary was that the British online newspaper archive at the British Library, without telling anybody they were going to do it, digitised all of the suffrage press, which they launched in February to commemorate the centenary. This was an absolutely fantastic thing. Annoyingly, I'd been working on a project with Historic England that I'll talk about a little bit in a moment, that involved working through the suffrage press, and because they didn't give anybody direct notice of this, it meant that I had literally spent probably the best part of a month doing 8-hour days solidly trawling through these things on microfilm in the reading room in the Borthwick Library, which, as Claire has just reminded me, is a jolly cold place to be. And actually, I could have done it all at the touch of a button within the space of a week. But never mind, it's there now. The other annoying thing about that, if anybody is interested in using this as a means of working for suffrage, is that, of course, they have done most of the suffrage press, but there are little bits and pieces that they aren't aware about because they're not obviously suffrage presses, that they haven't digitised. And for example, it's very difficult for the early years of the suffrage movement to get at it from the press because that doesn't start going. So what we really need, if anybody has any input with that particular organisation, what we really need is the Labour leader and the Clarion, please. And then when we get those, everything will be sorted. But what's great about the newspaper library is that it allows you to fill in the bits that realistically you just would not have the time to find otherwise. And this is a really good example. We all know, those of us who are suffrage scholars, we all know that the Women's Social and Political Union was founded in October 1904 in the drawing room, the front room, of Emmeline Pankhurst's rather modest little terraced house in Manchester. And at that first meeting, we know where Mrs. Pankhurst, we don't think her daughter Christabel was actually at the first meeting, because although Christabel later came round to the union, in its very early days, she was rather bored by her mother's suffrage activity. Sylvia was certainly there at the first meeting. Rachel Scott, who was the wife of the secretary of the Manchester branch of the Independent Labour Party, was there. And a number of other women, all from the Independent Labour Party, none of whose names we even know now. And we know that this was when it was formed. And then we know little bits and pieces from Annie Kenny's autobiography, from Teresa Billington's manuscript fragments in the Women's Library, that they started having meetings around the wakes in Manchester and Oldham the following summer, that they started public outdoor meetings. But what we can now find out at the click of a button is some of the things that happened from the gap between that very first WSPU meeting that's reported in the Labour Leader and when things start to become much more public around the general election campaign of 1905. So we see here that barely a month after the union is founded, its members are lobbying local MPs. And this is exactly what Emmeline Pankhurst said the point of her union was in the very beginning. They were all members of the Independent Labour Party. The Independent Labour Party was committed to giving women the vote and to arguing for votes for women. But increasingly, as its MPs were coming into Parliament, women in the party felt that they were rather being put on the back burner. So they were, in the words of the historian Sandra Holton, they were initially very much just a ginger group within the ILP. And here we see in the local newspaper them very much playing that role. And then, of course, in October 1905, everything famously changes. And this is when most historians would agree that the union becomes militant. Militancy meant many different things in the suffrage movement, and the meanings of what was militant shifted, and militancy is always best understood as a smorgasbord of activities. It escalated in terms of things becoming more violent, but it didn't escalate in terms of one form of militancy replacing another. And I'll say a little bit about that later on as well. So the very first militant act took place in a hall not unlike this one. And this is actually quite a good place to be in, because this was a place where suffragette meetings did take place during the height of the campaign. So it was in a hall not dissimilar from this one, the Free Trade Hall in Manchester. Some of you may know it. It's now, I think, a travel lodge or a Premier Inn or something, one of the budget hotel chains. And it was when Christabel and Annie went along with the banner that they're holding for the cameras there. They had seats in the gallery. They hung the banner over the edge of the gallery. They shouted, "Will the Liberal government give votes for women?" They were told to sit down. They refused to sit down, so they were shoved out of the hall. They refused to move outside, so they were eventually arrested for obstruction. And in Christabel's case, it was obstruction plus assault, because in order to get arrested, she was a law student and she wanted to be arrested so that they would get the publicity. In order to get arrested, she also spat at the police, although she said in her autobiography that she wrote in the 1950s, "It was not as much a spit as a dry pout. I could never have spat, not even to have got the vote." Anyway, job done, and they were arrested. And the site where this took place became more or less immediately a kind of suffrage shrine. And you see on the left the plaque which is inside the hall commemorating that very first event. And it was commemorated on that local space after the event, obviously, but way before the centenary, sometime in the 1950s, that plaque went up. But interestingly, that plaque is on the inside of the hall, whereas on the outside of the hall, there has been, for much, much longer, a blue plaque commemorating the site of the Peterloo Massacre, because the Free Trade Hall is one of these layered sites, these sort of layered historic sites where you have a radical history building on top of a radical history. After 1905, the movement very much goes national, and headquarters shifts down to London in 1906. literally around the corner from here in Clements Inn, in offices which were never intended as offices. They were the flat of Emmeline and Frederick Pethick Lawrence, but they give their flat over to the union to use as offices. And the historic focus at this point shifts to London. But I think, as you'll see from the pictures there, the regions remain the key. The picture on the left, the map on the left, is one that Diane Atkinson put together for her book Rise Up Women that came out last year. And Di has put this together because there are no branch records remaining for the WSPU. And anyone who's tried to do local suffrage history, this is always the first frustration when you discover that actually there are no longer any local records. So Di has put this together by trawling through, before it was digitised, columns of Votes for Women and the Suffragette and mapping where all the branches actually were. The map on the right represents the diversity of constitutional suffrage, because although I'm mainly going to be talking about militancy today, because it was the most spectacular and the most flamboyant, it's important to remember that there were also large numbers of constitutional suffragists. This was the map from the Great Pilgrimage of 1913, when suffragists from all over the country walked down to London, and the map shows the different routes down which they walked. And also that these just represent the two biggest organisations and, in a sense, the most extreme organisations. But by 1914, there were over 50 separate organisations whose main aim was getting the parliamentary vote for women. So there were occupational based, there was a teachers' suffrage organisation, writers, actresses, journalists, all sorts of occupations that had suffrage branches, religious suffrage societies, the Jewish League, the Church League, Catholic Women's Suffrage Society, Friends. There were regional-based ones. There was a separate Scottish organisation as well as Scottish branches of the bigger national ones. There was the Forward Cymric Union in Wales as well as branches of the national union. So really, so many different suffrage organisations and a lot of overlapping membership as well. So a lot of women would be members of two or three suffrage organisations at once. So the movement becomes national, but it takes place locally. And I think this is one of the most important things. The next one, it's a terribly poor resolution, I'm afraid, and this wasn't Conway Hall, this was actually Caxton Hall. And the WSPU started from about 1907 holding what they called women's parliaments in Caxton Hall. And the women's parliaments would be timed to coincide with a large event in Westminster. And Caxton Hall is literally a five-minute walk away from Westminster. It's now private apartments, but if you stand on the pavement outside Caxton Hall, you can see the towers of the Palace of Westminster. So it's a very, very, a very quick walk. And they would time these to take place if there was going to be a suffrage bill going through Parliament, or maybe at the opening of Parliament to see if it would be announced whether or not there would be a suffrage bill in that session, or if there was another piece of parliamentary business that had particular relevance to women, they would call these women's parliaments. So they had about 14 of them altogether between 1907 and 1907 and 1910, which was the last one. As the political historians in the room will know, there were large numbers of elections and various dissolutions of parliaments and things, so there was lots of activity going on, and these were held to coincide with these. And they were held on, they were a sort of delegate basis, so women would come down to London, their branch would club together to pay for their fare, and they began to follow a very sort of a very choreographed set piece. So they would sit in the hall, they would hear speeches from the platform, and then somebody, normally Emmeline Pankhurst, sometimes Christabel, sometimes Emmeline Pethick Lawrence, would move a resolution. They would have a written copy of the resolution, and they would say, "We will take this to Parliament." They would walk, they wouldn't march because you weren't allowed to march or demonstrate. They would walk in groups of two or three, but of course, although theoretically they had the right to enter Parliament and petition their MPs, it was a very, very staged thing. They knew the rules, the police knew the rules, the police would be out in force to try and stop them, they would try and get through the police lines, they would be arrested for obstruction, they would then go to the magistrates' courts, where they would be given the option of a fine because this is not actually a criminal offence, and they would refuse to pay the fine, and so they would be sent to prison. And the newspaper headlines then would concentrate on various things, the unfeminine behaviours of the women. The regional dimension got a lot of coverage in the newspaper, particularly when there were large numbers of working class women from the north, because London and the London media has always had a problem with working class women from the north coming down to London, so I apologise in advance. And the so headlines like clogs clattering in the Commons yards, and oh, this is sort of really outraged scenes. And just as in politics today, you sometimes feel, you know, reading some of the criticisms of our leaders of all hues, that in some cases they really are damned if they do and damned if they don't. One of the criticisms that the union got was that, oh, these women are paid to come down here because their fares are paid for them. Well, their fares were paid on a clubbing together basis because they were going down as delegates, and without that they couldn't have afforded to come. And if they didn't come, then the newspaper said, of course, working women aren't interested in the vote and women from outside the capital aren't interested in the vote. It's, you know, whatever the Edwardian equivalent of the metropolitan elite is that want the vote and nobody else is interested in it. So they were trying to show representation. But one of the things that got lost in this historically was the regional dimension. Although it's there in the press, although it's all about women coming down and women invading the capital, the historical focus on this somehow got lost to it becoming a case of it's London is where all the action is, London is where things take place and where things happen. In 1988, so quite a long time ago, and I think actually probably 1986 for the first edition, the first serious challenge to this was published, and some of you may be familiar with this already, and I'm sorry, I said 88, I meant 78, you can tell by the typeface if nothing else. Jill Liddington and Jill Morris's One Hand Tied Behind Us. This is a book about suffrage in Lancashire. It's largely a book about constitutional suffrage and the links between the constitutional suffrage movement, the women's trade union movement in the textile industries in Manchester, Lancashire, and Yorkshire, and the connections between these. And this book, and at the point at which it was written, they were able to also do quite a lot of oral history, quite a lot of interviews, not of any of the protagonists, it was a little bit too late for that by the 70s, but with many of the daughters of the women involved. So Doris Neal Chu, who was the daughter of Ada Neal Chu, Mary Cooper, who was the daughter of Selina Cooper. So a lot of people were still around that had first-hand stories of these that they'd heard from parents involved. And it kind of overturned the way that historians thought about suffrage by using the prism of local history to approach what is very much a question of national politics. But in switching it round, it also set up another paradox in a way, which was that women who were involved in the labour movement and involved in the trade union movement were only interested in constitutional suffrage, whereas it was middle-class women in London who were interested in militancy. And I think one of the really interesting things, of course, about setting up a paradigm is then other people will come along and try and overturn it. So I certainly built a not bad career for myself on proving that there were actually some working class women who were interested in militancy as well. And I think what most people would say now is that it's a far more mixed picture, and there are all sorts of different reasons why people got involved in different organisations. And on a personal note, when I was doing the research for my doctoral thesis, I interviewed a woman who was the daughter of a Liverpool suffragist called Jane Colquitt, and she had fallen into the movement. Jane actually went on the pilgrimage, but she had fallen into the movement by accident because she was with her mother, who was a pilot's wife and had been going to some sort of shipping pilot and had been going to some sort of pilot's wives gathering. And one of the younger pilot's wives said to her, "You don't want to sit around here listening to this. I'm going to a far more interesting meeting. Come with me." And Helena, the lady I interviewed, said, "And my grandmother was quite happy for her to go to the constitutional meetings because she knew she was with nice ladies." So I think there's often these kind of accidents in how you get involved as well. So building on the back of this, and this is just a tiny little representative sample, there are now, I think, dozens of local suffrage histories, and many of them have come out in the past 12 months. There used to be a standard footnote that you put in when you were writing about suffrage, and you wrote the sentence about local suffrage history and how local studies have really altered the way that we look at the national picture. And there was a standard footnote that had about 10 different texts in it. And I think now the standard footnote would be literally a page, because they keep on coming out and coming out and coming out, many of them in the past 12 months. And many of them, partly because of the availability of materials, as I said, particularly the digitization of the suffrage press has really, really speeded this up and made it massively affordable, because although I know my students still complain about the fact that British Newspaper Online is a subscription service and you have to pay for it, but it doesn't cost you anything like as much as it used to cost you to get the train down to London and the tube out to Colindale, and you couldn't start until 10 and you had to finish at 4, and if the guys were feeling a bit grumpy, it wasn't waiting for you anyway, type of thing. And I can see everyone's had that experience just looking around the room. So it's made it a lot easier, a lot more available, and a lot more affordable. Suffrage has also, as well as changing our local history, suffrage changed our local landscape. So I think the next thing I want to go and talk about is the way that the centenary has actually impacted on the physicality of the country that we live in. So at the time, it changed the landscape, and this was one of the ways in which this happened. Most of the suffrage societies, and we've got here an example of a WSPU shop in the bottom right-hand corner, and the top left-hand corner is a constitutional suffrage shop. Most of the unions would take these shops. They were often taken on quite short-term leases, so quite cheap. They would sometimes only have a shop for 6 months and then move to another premises. Sometimes they had them for 4 or 5 years. The shops served three purposes. They were for fundraising. They sold stuff. They sold literature. They sold what we might loosely call suffrage fashion accessories. That is, you could buy badges, you could buy scarves in the colours, you could buy suffragette jewellery. And then they also sold the kind of stamps, staple, country bazaar type fare, so homemade jam, homemade preserves, cakes, anything that, knitted tea cozies, cushions, anything that was small and portable and easily made and that you could build to make raise funds. They also saved money because most of them had a space that doubled as a meeting room, so increasingly the branches would have their weekly meetings there and not have to pay to hire a meeting room. And then they also served as an amazing public front, because of course shops have shop windows, and so you can put in the shop windows all manner of posters and propaganda material. And this became increasingly important after around about 1911, 1912, when militancy
moved and diverted into direct action against property, because at that point a lot of local authorities would refuse to give permission for suffragette posters to be displayed on advertisement billboards, and so being able to display your own publicity in your own premises was a really important part of this. And they're also a very important part in the Edwardian period of women claiming public space. And there's a lot of talk about the suffrage movement, and there's a lot of talk at the time about it only being for middle-class women, which wasn't true. But anyway, even if it was true, there's something incredibly pejorative about this that is taking the agency away from the women who have actually made the decision to join the organisation and get involved in politics, like saying, oh, but because you're middle-class, that doesn't even count. It's just like a sort of plaything. But for a lot of middle-class women in the Edwardian era, it was actually more difficult to do anything in public. And in fact, this wasn't very long after the Victorian period, when public woman was another way of saying prostitute. If you describe someone as a public woman, the very phrase public woman was a euphemism for, I guess, what my granny would have called someone who was no better than she should be, and that kind of being private. So having the shops, having the presence, and you see on the bottom there, another way that they used to get around the advertising ban was to literally transform themselves into advertisement, into walking advertisements. So, like sandwich men. Well, of course, sandwich. Well, you don't have sandwich men anymore, do you? but you used to, and they would generally be advertising various newspapers and things. And of course, this was one of the lowest jobs that you could do, walking around with an advertisement on yourself. So, for women to appropriate this, it was actually, for many of them, it was quite a big step. And you know, some of the sadder stories that you come across when you're doing suffrage history, there are stories of women whose husbands try and take their children away from them, who throw them out of the home. I was going to go on and just describe some of the things about the film Suffragette, but one of the things that we did when we were making the film, and I worked with Abby Martin very closely on the script and with Sarah Gavron, the director, before there was even a film and before there even was a script. And when we were talking about it, one of the things that Sarah really wanted to do was tell an ordinary story, but originally, I was very keen to get it out of London, and we did sort of play around with that. And I think that was my only regret, that I didn't want it to be set in London, because I said, you know, you're talking about ordinary people and you also need to take it away from the capital. But the obverse argument was that, of course, those of you who've seen the film, it's much easier for the plot if you've got somebody who gets caught up in absolutely the maelstrom of it, where everything's actually happening in the capital. But although the key figure, Maud Watts, was not a real woman, every single thing that happened to Maud Watts happened to a real person in the suffrage campaign. We made her up out of an amalgam of different people's stories and different events. And this idea that, you know, your husband would throw you out, you could have your children taken away. There's a really interesting case in the National Archives of a gentleman who writes to the governor of the prison while his wife is a suffragette prisoner and says, I'm absolutely convinced she's insane and I want you to get the prison authorities to declare her as insane, because what other reason could there possibly be for her actions? So, so I think sort of moving away, this still did focus on the capital, but it's this sort of layering of spaces as well. Now, in the centenary year, government finally woke up to this, and this caught us rather on the hop. The budget in 2017 just happened to come out on International Women's Day. So for some reason, which nobody understood at the time, and I think nobody understands since, Philip Hammond announced in the budget that he was going to put several million pounds into grants that were going to support commemorating the suffrage centenary. And this then, it kind of got a bit sidelined, partly because Theresa May then called an election unexpectedly, so nobody was doing anything, and literally nobody knew where the money was. You know, you'd ring Treasury, you'd email Treasury, nobody would respond, nobody would reply, nobody was sure what was going on. It finally, by early 2018, where things were still looking quite chaotic, it finally focused on a lot of smaller projects mainly. And it did, that was a thing from The Guardian about a year ago. It did attract a lot of criticism. And I think it's quite easy to criticise what was, in a sense, a very poorly thought through, off the cuff fund. But I think what's really interesting about it is that while it's really easy to stand by and criticise, on the other hand, I think, well, at least they were doing something and they were trying to do something. And a lot of the smaller projects, I couldn't tell you what they were and what happened to them, but some of the more interesting ones, one of the things it went into was something called the Equalities Initiative. I don't know if any of you actually came across this. This took place in June and July last year, but there were a couple of them that kind of hung around in August. And you had an event in your locality, and it had to involve tea, hence equality with a T-E-A on the end. And you could, if you wanted to, go the whole hog and get the suffrage board game as well. They'd sort of, the government sent out a pack. But what it gave you was a kind of branding kit, so you got your bunting and you got your invitations, and people did them in all sorts of different ways. I spoke at a number of them, and I think every other suffrage historian spoke at a number of them as well. And the idea was that people would get together, they'd talk a little bit about what suffrage meant then, what the vote means today. They had some suggested questions and discussion questions, and they were very nice events and very interesting events. On a larger scale, although interestingly, it was very difficult to find out. I was looking last night to see if I could find a summary. Other than the initial announcement and then a lot of stuff on the individual cities' websites, I don't think there has been a proper evaluation yet of the centenary cities. But they did set up these particular cities to be centenary cities. So Bolton, Bristol, Leeds, Leicester, London, Manchester, and Nottingham. And they were given particular tranches of funding to run particular events celebrating that. Nottingham, for instance, had a day when all of the buildings in the city were lit up in suffrage colours for, well, it were night, because obviously you couldn't see them in the daytime, and various different things going on. And another project that was very much past the centenary and one that I was very much involved in was Historic England's project to map the impact of suffrage on the built environment and then commemorate it. We were hoping that we would be able to get a new listing as well, but it proved impossible to find anywhere that met both the criteria as a site where significant suffrage activity had taken place and a building that met the listing. We were really, really hopeful for the WSPU shop in Sheffield, because that's one of the very few WSPU shops which is still standing today, but the building itself has been altered too much, so it was deemed unsuitable for listing for this reason. But what we did do was identify over 40, 41 historic sites that had previously been listed and were then relisted with amended text that demonstrated the suffrage associations. And we limited it to militant suffrage because it was a very, very short turnaround project. We had 2 months from start to finish in which to get this off the ground. And I think it was interesting because it showed how the suffragette movement had impacted on the built environment of the country in ways that we hadn't really guessed about, but in buildings that we already knew were significant. So And so it really showed the spatial and temporal dimensions of political campaigns. And of course, again, very much rooted in the local, because we were really trying to go for sites outside of London as well as sites inside. And obviously limited, because it's historic England, limited to English sites. So many of the sites that were relisted, for example, several churches, a small number of which were listed because they were subject to attacks during the militant campaign, but others because they were part of what was called the Prayers for Prisoners initiative. And this was one of the very last forms of militancy to evolve. It starts in 1913, so it starts very, very close to the outbreak of war. And it involved women nearly always did it in groups. I can't think of an example where it was just one woman. It was nearly always two or three women who would go together. So they would go to a church, normally an Anglican church, occasionally a Catholic church. And in any part of the liturgy where it is expected that there will be silence, they would stand up and not really shout and not declaim, but they would stand up and say, God bless Mrs. Pankhurst, God save all the women who are suffering in prison, God save all the women who are on hunger strike. So it was quite a respectful form of protest and quite a decorous form of protest, offering up prayers for suffragette prisoners. And these provoked the most violent, some of the most violent reactions of the suffrage campaign. So, for example, York Minster women were physically ejected. Remember, church wardens can still bear arms, they can still bear their staves in church. Women were physically ejected. Liverpool Cathedral, this is the greatest irony, the only bit of Liverpool Cathedral that was open at that point was the Lady Chapel. And if anyone's ever been in the Lady Chapel of Liverpool Cathedral, it really does celebrate famous women. So there's a window for Josephine Butler, there's a window for Florence Nightingale. You know, it really celebrates the contribution of women to religion. And having been physically picked up and carried out, women were then banned from attending services at the Legislative Chapel for the next week or so. So very interesting, this, because it's a new form of militancy, comes quite late on in the campaign, non-violent direct action, but provoking very violent reactions. So we listed, not all by any means, but we relisted a number of churches that had been involved in this protest. And some buildings were relisted because they escaped damage. And this is the old grammar school at King's Norton in Birmingham, which was broken into one night by suffragettes who left a message on the blackboard that said to suffragettes, and they left all the things that they would normally leave after an arson attack. So suffrage literature, scarves and things in the colours, and then just left a notice on the blackboard saying that we broke in, but we were so charmed by the old world atmosphere of the room that we decided not to do any damage and we've left it alone. So the centenary has seriously altered our landscape, and I think most famously, sorry, that's a very bad resolution, but here's poor old Theresa May on one of the days when she was cheerful when she's giving the speech at the unveiling of Millicent Fawcett's statue. And this is probably the most famous landmark of the centenary campaign. The first statue ever of a woman in Parliament Square. And I think what's really great about the statue is that it's not just of Millicent Fawcett, because of course there was a huge thing about, should it be Millicent, should it be Emmeline? Well, Emmeline has got a statue there, but it's just a bit round the corner. And, you know, or should it be somebody else? So one of the compromises that the mayor's office came up with is that underneath the plinth are 59 other individuals who were also very heavily involved in the suffrage campaign, and there were about a dozen of us who were involved in choosing the names of the people who were going to go around the plinth. And again, What was at the height of that was diversity, both in terms of tactics and in terms of class, but particularly in terms of regions and localities. So trying to get as many women and men who were doing things for suffrage in places other than London, so you get a real sense of the national movement. And then, of course, the statue issue really starts to change the landscape in other parts of the country as well. And I think this is one part of the centenary celebrations that I feel a little bit ambivalent about, because to my mind, statues are both permanent but also in a sense quite temporary. And I say this as somebody who grew up in Liverpool and then worked in Leeds and cities which are full of wonderful statues of great Victorian men. And I think it is true that there are more statues of goats in the UK than there are of women still. And I think that I think that's true. I heard it on the wireless, so it must be. I puzzled about that, and then I thought regimental goats, that'll be it. It'll be all of those military statues. But on the other hand, I'm not sure that the statue is as permanent as people think it is going to be. I think maybe in 50, 60 years' time, people will be walking past these and saying, but I'm not sure who that person is. But nonetheless, we have now Alice Hawkins in Leicester. She was very atypical. In a sense, she has become famous through her atypicality, because she was both a militant suffragette and also a member of the Independent Labour Party and a very active member of her trade union. She also has, a great-grandson who is terribly active in the campaign of perpetuating her memory. So he was quite involved in the move to get the statue for Alice in Leicester, Annie Kenny in Oldham. And again, that's very interesting, because there was a big campaign in Oldham to kind of bring her back to Oldham, because she's always associated with Christabel and she's always associated with Manchester. So again, a very big local dimension to this. And of course, Emmeline, who is still in Tower Gardens, despite a rather bizarre attempt to relocate her last year, which nobody could quite understand what was behind that. But apparently Westminster Council received the highest number of objections to that planning application than that they've had for any planning application ever. So Emmeline is still there in Tower Gardens, but she is also, of course, now in Manchester on the site of so many of her meetings. So the local campaigns have been very, very keen to do this. There are moves for a statue of Emily Davison. There is also, there is going to be a statue of Nancy Astor, of course, famously never a suffragist or a suffragette, but a very significant politician whose centenary is coming up on the wake of the suffrage centenary. And the other thing which I think I feel far less ambivalent about is that there have been a vast number, and this one's for Claire because it's in Coney Street, a vast number of blue plaques of various different devices, some by local civic organisations, some by the official blue plaques, some quasi-official blue plaques. And all of these have come out of projects that have taken place as part of uncovering the local history. So, for example, the site of the WSPU's offices in Coney Street is not in itself a historic building. It's not in itself a building that's worthy that merits listing, because it's gone through far too many changes. But you can still put a plaque on it and sort of layer the landscape in that way. A far more interesting and imaginative form of commemorating the centenary, I think, came in a number of community projects, all of which were underpinned by local histories and the work of local historians, both professional, quasi-professional, or sometimes community project groups. So, for example, in York, we did the most fantastic community suffrage play, which involved a professional theatre company, a small number of professional actors, a professional playwright, and then a purely amateur cast. So it's a community play, an amazing community project, and it took place both inside and outside. So it's, I'm not sure, did anyone go? Did Claire go? Did Ted go? Good heavens, what were you doing last summer? It started off outside York Minster as a piece of open-air theatre, rather like the mystery plays, and then moved in procession to the theatre where the actual performance took place inside the theatre. And the plaque that I just showed you in the previous slide is actually part of the legacy of that project, which is why it's co-branded by both the theatre company and the and York Civic Trust, because it was a sort of joint operation between the two. And there were similar projects went on in different parts of the country. There was a great one in Manchester by a semi-professional youth theatre company called She Bangs the Drums, which mixed historic and contemporary. So for those of you in the room who don't get the reference, the title is a lyric from a Stone Roses song, so it's kind of lifting quasi-contemporary, like at least modern modern references to women in Manchester, and then it went right back to the suffrage movement. And that was one I was a little bit involved with, and that was just really good fun, because what they wanted on that, the young people were writing the script themselves, and as I say, the particular company is a mixture of the youngest ones are still at school, the eldest members are at drama college, and some of them now are on the cusp of becoming quasi-professional. So they didn't want a writer, they wanted to write it themselves, and they didn't want a researcher, but what they wanted was somebody who could come along and just tell them, how do I do this? How do I find this? You know, how do I find an old newspaper? How do I find an archive? And then they just went off and did it all themselves and found it all out. And that was a really interesting one. And again, this sort of mixture of the historic and contemporary. And then other things, the top picture, some of you may have seen this, was in Birmingham Station, and they did these kind of temporary installations of local Birmingham suffragettes. And the woman in the picture there is a woman called Hilda Burkett, who was very involved in the suffrage movement locally in Birmingham. One of the interesting things about Hilda Burkett is, like Alice Hawkins, it's one of those situations where the great grandchildren and the great great grandchildren who never knew the women concerned. And in Hilda Burkett's case, actually, she never got married. I think it's her great great niece who did a master's degree and is now researching into her family's suffrage history on the back of this. So another thing that's come out of the centenary at local level is this kind of remembering and re-engaging. And as a suffrage historian of, you know, sort of 25, 30 years standing, I can tell you this is very, very new. When I did my research on Liverpool in the late 80s, early 90s, it was more or less impossible to find anybody that had any connection at all, despite, you know, letters in newspapers, appeals on local radio and things. But since the centenary, I've had a number of unsolicited emails from people who are great-grandchildren or great-nieces or great-nephews saying, oh, I'm researching my grandmother, or my great-grandmother or what have you, so I read your book. So I think there's this real sort of interest in it coming back in again. Processions. That's a terribly bad slide because I screenshot it from the television, because in the scarf, in the bottom, is my daughter. That's why I screenshot it from the TV. Processions is was the most amazing event. Did anyone go on processions? One person, fantastic. Processions was absolutely amazing. It was run by an art installation company called Artichoke, and they had, and so I sort of know the woman that put it together, and she kept, we were on the radio together the day before it was on, and they kept saying, demonstration, she kept saying, it's not a demonstration. And she said to me afterwards, we've not got police permission for a demonstration, because you need completely different policing permission. And she kind of done a deal with, she'd said, you know, this is not a demonstration, it's a procession, it's an art installation, but it's not a demonstration. So this being, having it referred to as a demonstration was not helpful like 2 days before. But this took place in all the four capitals of the UK at the same time on a Sunday afternoon. And the idea was that you just turned up, and nobody knew how many people were going to turn up. But it was a lovely day. It was really nice weather. So certainly on the London one, literally hundreds of thousands of people turned up, and then they just divided everybody up and gave everybody a free scarf or scarves in one of the colours, so either purple or white or green, and then you walked in your columns. And from the air, it looked amazing, and it was really, really long as well. So again, a very big event, a very imaginative event, and a very different way of connecting people. And one of the things that was funded out of the, in some areas, out of the Centenary Fund, to go along with processions for about 3 months prior to the day of processions, Artichoke had started banner making workshops in various places all over the country. And so a lot of women who came down with their banners that they'd embroidered, and many of the banners were commemorating local women, and again, a lot of research went on for local stories in local areas for their banners. So I think, to sum up, the centenary has reacquainted everybody with the notion of suffrage and its local dimensions. And I think for a lot of local history groups, it's been a very invigorating experience. There is, one has to say, a lack of critical dimension to some or much of the published work. And the emphasis is very much on recording what did the suffragettes do in Frome, in Glasgow, in Bristol, in Wellingborough. But the most interesting things, I think, were the dynamic events that came out of this, the community plays, processions, the maybe not so much the permanent statues, but the temporary visual representations, the lighting up of buildings in suffragette colours. And the challenge now, I suppose, is to see how much of this actually remains. So particularly in local history groups, will there now be an interest in finding out more about women's lives in the 60s, in the 70s, in the 80s, or are we going to have to wait for the next centenary, which will be 2028? So I think that's the question I would leave you with. Thank you.